This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to this special podcast to mark the publication of our CIO Autumn Update, which is focused on the key themes and implications for investors of the US presidential election. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and while I'm dialing in from London, I'm delighted to be joined by our speakers who, appropriately given the subject matter, are all joining us from our Chicago office. On our panel is Sonia Loud, Elgium's CIO, and from Elgium America, we have Jason Shoup, CIO and co-head of Global Fixed Income, Jason Becker, head of US Credit Strategy, and Anthony Woodside, head of Multi-Sector Fixed Income and Investment Strategy. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Max.
Good morning.
Good morning.
With no further ado, Sonia, our main topic today is the US election. But before we dive into that, there have been recently some big macro and market developments broadly unrelated to politics. What's top of mind for you right now?
Thank you, Max, and good morning, everyone. And I probably should say that I've only traveled to Chicago to do the CIO call live from the States. And because, as you said, we're trying to cover the US election and the implications today. But before we do so, I'm surrounded by a lot of experts. Let me try and do the kind of overview of what happened elsewhere. And of course, I have to start with central banks because we had the Fed meeting last week and widely anticipated they did cut. But what probably wasn't as widely anticipated clearly just like 1 or 2 weeks ago is that they would go by 50 basis points. Elsewhere, we had the ECB cutting by 25 basis points and probably more surprising, the Bank of England on hold. Now, whilst this were the most important major changes over the past week or so, it's important now to put it in context because I believe what investors are mostly interested in is, has the narrative changed? And our regular listeners will know that we have been following this idea of a narrow path thesis for quite some time. What does it mean that it is that markets have been particularly focused on this idea of a softening global growth backdrop, but still very solid. So this idea of a soft landing, which implies that inflation will move towards target. And of course, this would allow the central banks to react, but it's pretty much a Goldilocks scenario. Now, if you look at the underlying data, there has been a bit more noise and a bit more noise in the context that it has been weaker across the board. And as such, of course, maybe not such a surprise that the Fed went by 50 basis points. In particular, we had the labor market data in the US that is giving more reason for concern. We've just actually hot off the press had the European PMIs, which clearly were weaker than expected, coming in at 48.9. I know we had a post-Olympics boost, but that clearly is wearing off. And the expectation for Q4 growth actually have been downgraded to just 0.1%. Then we have had services inflation that remains sticky actually across the board. And again, in the UK coming back to home, it is clear that the GDP data has not been particularly exciting. So again, is it enough to change the narrative? Probably not quite. And this is why we are seeing the market reacting in a way that is quite volatile, really overinterpreting every incoming data point. And it's clear that we are not yet on a new narrative. We're not yet on a clear path for markets. Now, alongside, I would be amiss not to mention politics, particularly because we have the Labour Party conference happening this week. And of course, this will hopefully give some indication on the upcoming budget, clearly something that the UK will watch very carefully to see what Labour is putting forward in terms of their plans. Equally important maybe is the state elections in Germany that we have been seeing in the East. And this is particularly noteworthy because we have seen a very strong showing of the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party. That's the extreme right-wing party in Germany. And of course, we will all take note because if they were represented in any of the state governments, that would have severe implications. Elsewhere, and equally noteworthy, we had Michel Barnier being appointed as the Prime Minister in France. Most people will know Michel Barnier as the Brexit negotiator on the European side. Everybody now hopes that he can pull off the state budget. Now, why does it all matter? I think we have highlighted in the past, politics create a lot of headlines, a lot of noise, but very often not a real impact on the market trajectory. Why is that? Because the market at the end of the day will only react if there's a meaningful impact on the longer term growth trajectory or on inflation. But this is why it's probably worth quoting one of Rachel Reeves headlines this morning, that she claims Labour is the party of fiscal responsibility. That is the one statement the market will take note, because we know that all governments around the world actually have a balancing act to juggle, which is the immediate needs that are arising, of course, particularly from the level of inequality, the overhang of the cost of living crisis, with the need for long-term structural investment in order to boost economic growth over the medium to long term. That is not an easy undertaking if you consider the lack of fiscal headroom that we're seeing that most governments are confronted with. And I think that's probably the best way to stop, because I know that fiscal sustainability clearly is a topic that will feature quite heavily here in the US as well.
Well, thank you very much, Sonia, for that overview of those dynamics. My takeaway there is we've got noisy data meets noisy politics, with, of course, very important fiscal implications. It's a great point to bring Jason Shoup into the call. Jason, in our CIO Autumn Update, you write that despite all of the political drama, markets haven't really taken note of the US election. Why do you think this might change as we enter the final weeks?
Hi, Max. Good morning, everyone. Maybe I'll take a moment and just explain what I mean that markets haven't taken note first, and then I'll get into what might change as we get closer here to the election. I guess the first thing about is sort of how markets always behave, right? Is they struggle to focus on more than one thing at any given time, right? And so while this has truly been an unusual election so far, in the sense that we had a debate much earlier than is typical between Biden and Trump, and that eventually produced a new candidate for the Democrats, it's really difficult to kind of maintain the attention of markets for 5 months, right, straight. So, and I guess the first point would be is that things like the Fed and central banks have really been taking, center stage along with the labor market and the data. And from a market's perspective, that the attention has not really been on politics as much as you might otherwise expect. And I guess the other way that, markets haven't taken notice and why they haven't taken notice, it's just because the race is still so very close, right, and hard to call. I mean, in the aftermath of that Biden-Trump debate, there was a time when Trump took a really commanding lead in the polls as support for Biden collapsed. But we're now really back to a race that's sort of, a coin flip. It's a toss-up. And it's pretty amazing that we are, right, because you're talking about, an illustration of how the U.S. electorate, how evenly politicized they've become, right? You can effectively change candidates in the middle of a race, and it almost doesn't matter at all. You're back to 50-50, right? So despite all that political drama, that's what I mean when there really hasn't been much change for markets to yet get excited about. I guess the interesting thing about things not changing that much is that we still see this greater than 50% probability that one of the parties actually sweeps Congress and captures the presidency, while most pundits and most of the political press out there have a much lower probability of that sort of an outcome, mostly because they think the Senate is a foregone conclusion for the Republicans, and they expect the House to be kind of an independent toss-up. But I guess I would emphasize two things, right? If Harris wins, the Dems only need 50 senators to take control of the Senate, which could come down to two Senate races in Montana and Ohio. So I wouldn't write that off as quickly as others have. And then the second thing I would emphasize is that the idea of split voting in the U.S., where a voter would vote for the president of one party, but a House or a senator from the other party, has really been declining through the decades. So it's very, very likely that whichever way the presidency goes, the House will go as well. So from our perspective, we think the combined probability of either a Republican or a Democratic sweep is really being underestimated just as much today as it was earlier in the year before the Biden and Trump debate. And in the next few weeks, it wouldn't surprise us if markets actually start to take far more notice of that as we get into this sort of like within the 45-day window to the election, and the elections can finally be the thing that markets focus on.
Well, thanks, Jason. That's very clear. The risk of a sweep is being underpriced by markets, in your view. Let's turn to Jason Becker now. Jason, as Sonia mentioned, we've just had a particularly important Fed meeting. How do you think monetary policy might be different under Trump than under a Harris administration?
Sure. I think many people would start answering this question by talking about the perceived politicization of the Fed, particularly something that's been heavily discussed in the last week. Personally, I don't find too much weight to those arguments. I don't think there's strong supporting evidence that Powell nor his predecessors were extremely political in their times as Fed chairs. I would also note that Powell is a registered Republican. And perhaps if politics were driving monetary policy decisions, you may have expected him to go 25 basis points last week rather than 50. In terms of the candidates themselves, Trump has said many times that he's a low rates guy, definitely would prefer more of a dovish lean to the Fed, particularly focused on the growth mandate and driving strong growth. Harris, similar to many of her other policy decisions, has not explicitly stated her intentions for an independent Fed or for more of a dovish or hawkish nature. But I think given her prior policy and the Biden administration in general, I think we can expect that she would probably lean more dovish as well. So not too much of a divergence there between the two candidates. I think what really comes down to is it's the market and economic impacts of the election itself that will drive Fed policy in terms of their dual mandate. I think if you see a Harris victory and markets start to wobble, tightening financial conditions, I think the Fed might look to act a little bit quicker in terms of bringing policy closer to neutral in a more expedient fashion to try to offset some of that financial condition tightening. And on the flip side, if you see Trump win and you see stocks set new all-time highs, the Fed might act a little bit slower in returning policy to neutral. But I think the key thing here is in either of those scenarios, that's very dependent on employment normalizing. If we see the unemployment rate continue to rise in the U.S., I think the Fed acts quickly. And as Trump would say, the Fed would act bigly under either candidate.
Okay, we'll watch out for that potential bigly response reaction function. Anthony, here's a related question. What do you think the outlook for U.S. credit markets is under the most likely post-election scenarios we've just been discussing?
Thanks, Max. Well, I think when we talk about the outlook for U.S. credit, we must start with how expensive valuations are today. When you look at investment-grade credit, spreads are at the tighter end of the historical spectrum. And when you look at high yield is very compressed from a spread perspective as well, especially considering the restrictive monetary policy regime we've been in for the last 12 to 18 months. With that being said, our base case is that the U.S. economy will avoid a recession, and that should provide a generally supportive environment for credit. However, if spreads were to enter the U.S. election period in a similar zip code to where we are today, we do see risks for spreads to go wider from here. Now, that being said, we do think that election and the outcomes are going to be important here. So let's break down the various scenarios. As Jason Shoup already alluded to, we believe that the risk of a sweep is being underpriced by the market. And we do think that if you do get a sweep, the yield curve is likely to continue to steepen here because we're already at a starting point where you have outsized deficits. And we think that that would only be exacerbated if you have, irrespective of which party was to win in the election from here. So if you talk about the outcome for credit markets, it's a little bit more nuanced from our perspective. If the Democrats were able to pull off a sweep here, we do think that the risk is for spreads to go wider. And that's partially predicated on the view that the market will find it to be a little bit more negative if you do have an increase in corporate taxes here, or if you do have a scenario where that you have an increase in capital gains taxes and increased regulation here. Conversely, if you have the Republican sweep, the outlook is complicated by two diametrically opposed forces. We do think that the prospect for lower corporate taxes will be supportive for credit, but we do think for more far-reaching tariffs is something that could weigh on the sector. Now, if history is a guide, a divided government is likely to be interpreted relatively positively by markets here. So overall, the way I would sum it up is there are likely to be winners and losers depending on the election outcomes. So sector and security selection is going to be of paramount importance. And then secondly, we continue to maintain that at the end of the day, the economic backdrop and company-specific fundamentals are going to be what is the ultimate deciding factors for the trajectory of U.S. credit.
Thanks, Anthony. Sonia, the election in November is, of course, only one of a huge number this year across the world. Which of the themes most common in what some are calling a festival of democracy are most relevant to investors?
Not quite sure I would have called it a festival of democracy, but it's very true that we have been seeing, of course, a vast range of elections across the globe. And it is important to take a step back and see what are the common denominators in terms of themes that have clearly been dominating the outcomes. I've highlighted the level of inequality that has been clearly rising and where we are seeing an increasing backlash vote against the implications of these, exacerbated in many parts of the world by the cost of living crisis on the back of the COVID crisis. But again, nothing new really, other than that we are reaching levels where voters very clearly say, I had enough. I would like to see change, and I would like my immediate concerns being reflected in the governing party's statements, and I would like to see remedial action in order to help me. That's really, in a nutshell, what we are seeing. We have seen this in Mexico. We've seen it in India. We've seen it in France, the European elections in the UK. And even if this is not necessarily at the forefront here in the US, there is, of course, a level of pushback to say, I would like to see more support for medium and low-level income households. And this ranges from access to medical care. It ranges from schooling, education. It is ranging, of course, you know, the inflationary impact on household goods and hence the impact on available income. So, and of course, and this is probably the elephant in the room and very obvious everywhere, is immigration. There's very few politicians that would willingly gamble their political capital to do what I believe is the inevitable. The government that will be able to have the right framework for immigration is probably setting the best starting point for any country to look for a sustained growth path. It is a topic that will not go away. It is the topic that will probably define the next decade or so, because, of course, the Balancing Act is very clear. You have declining population growth across most of the developed countries, i.e. in order to keep your economic growth path alive, you will need population growth. If you can't find it in your own country, you will need immigration to make up for it. And therein lies the crux, because, of course, there's a big difference in getting skilled workers in your country versus illegal immigrants, all those, of course, from countries where they do require protection. It is that balancing act, which is, of course, so incredibly difficult. And if we look at the geopolitical situation, it's very clear that right now it is the latter part of immigration that dominates the headlines and which is so difficult to square. So these are the defining common denominators across all the elections. And I think this is what I've been trying to refer to right at the outset. That's the difficulty in balancing what are the immediate needs of my population versus the pressing need, and this is again very obvious, particularly in Europe, the pressing need to invest in structural drivers and structural reform areas, digitization, infrastructure, energy transition, you name it. But how do you balance it against the backdrop of very, very tight fiscal headroom? And that's not an easy one to pull off. And we have seen it actually. India probably was a big surprise because there was such an expectation for Modi to bring home a vast majority. And the Indian South has said, no, we would like you to focus on domestic policies. We would like your budget to be more balanced to make sure that there's a fair spread and that clearly the agricultural-based part of the economy will see equal support. Now, every country will have very specific items. I know in the UK, the NHS reform will weigh very heavily on the spending balance. But at the core is what I've outlined is a backlash vault that says, I had enough. I would like the politicians in power to do something for me now.
Thanks, Sonia. That's a really interesting analysis of a long-term theme that's clearly hugely significant on both sides of the Atlantic and globally. To Jason Shoup, let's return to the US election in particular. When you speak to clients, what are they most interested in or perhaps hopeful or worried about in the presidential race from a purely markets and investments perspective?
Maybe death and taxes are the old standby. Okay. Maybe, hopefully not death, but definitely taxes. Probably followed by something that, you know, both Sonia and Anthony have mentioned, which would be immigration and tariffs, right? I think this election is pretty consequential, and investors understand that. Mostly from the tax perspective, you have the Trump tax cuts from his first administration expiring at the end of 2025. And I think most would argue that immigration, the net inflows into the U.S., and the fiscal stimulus from the last few years have played a huge part in the strength and the resiliency of the U.S. economy for the last 2 years, when honestly recession at times felt sort of inevitable, right? So I think we can make the argument that if the appetite for U.S. immigration lessens, or the appetite for immigration, I should say, in the U.S. lessens, either authorized or unauthorized, it's very likely that the initial conditions for the next president of the U.S. will be considerably worse going forward, particularly as we mentioned right at the beginning, hiring is already starting to slow in the U.S., right? So I think when you get into the election and our investors and clients, I think would agree, the first order of business will be to do no harm in 2025, right? Either you have to extend the current tax code as Trump would like, or modify it in such a way that it doesn't become a fiscal cliff to the economy and a big risk for risk assets. And I think that would be Harris's plan, of course, higher taxes on high earning individuals and corporates, but and also an enhancement of transfer payments as well. What we don't hear much about, and we've already talked about it a little bit here, is the deficit and the sort of any angst that the deficit could create. That seems to be one of those things that the markets hasn't yet turned its attention to. And if we get a sweep, it seems like that level of antipathy could change next year, right? We'd expect there would be a real great temptation for any party who has total control to lean into fiscal stimulus again as hiring slows, as the measures such as tariffs or tax hikes potentially take a toll on growth. And at some point, I think I agree with Sonia here, you could imagine the bonds market start to take greater note and you start to test this concept of what the fiscal headroom in the U.S. precisely is, which, let's be clear, to date seems endless, right? There's a certain amount of allowance for fiscal deficits in the U.S. that no other country on the planet would be given. But it's very possible that in the next year, we get a chance to see if markets can really withstand another increase to the deficit if we were to get a sweep.
Thanks, Jason. Jason Becker, building on Anthony's comments earlier, how's the team positioning more broadly across U.S. credit?
Sure. So sort of on the macro front, I would just make the point that as we wrote about in the autumn update, and then as Jason Shoup reiterated today, election risks really are not being priced into aggregate credit spreads. And then secondly, I would say that our investment process, we focus on things where we believe and we have historically shown to have an edge in the market. And I certainly wouldn't say election forecasting falls into that category. So really, our positioning has been much more focused on the supply and demand technicals and macro catalysts within the market. So we've been very technical, tactical in terms of our positioning. Specifically, recently, we've been net long into the recent rally, as we've seen a lot of inflows as people in money market funds have been moving some of that money out of, you know, the money market funds and extending duration out the curve, buying some IG and high yield credit for very strong inflows into the asset class. And supply has maybe disappointed, particularly in long duration credit over the last couple of weeks. Finally, I'll just make the point that in terms of valuations, we are now reaching the post-COVID tights within spitting distance once again. So there has been some debate amongst the team about taking our positioning down, reducing the beta perhaps into the next non-farm payrolls report coming up in a couple weeks. Then maybe more on the micro, I can talk a little bit about the tariff risk and how that's evident within credit markets. We have selected a basket of companies where they have meaningful China or other global import or exports. And we found that that basket of corporates has really traded and correlated quite well with the odds of Trump winning the presidency. And that's particularly notable over the past 2 months. That's not something that we'd put positioning on again ahead of the election, because we don't think we have an edge in terms of Trump's odds of winning. But we have seen, looking back into 2018, that there's been particular underperformance at the issuer level when tariffs were first announced, as tariff concerns grew in 2018 and into September of when the 10% Chinese tariffs were announced, and then throughout the trade war into 2019. So we sort of have a basket of companies that we'd be willing to either buy, go long in that basket, or short that basket, selling it to go underweight after the election, as we believe that those companies will perform depending on if Trump takes office or not on tariff risks.
Thanks, Jason. So a focus on technicals, macro catalysts, and valuations there rather than election forecasting. And your response is a great segue to our next question. Anthony, reflecting on your earlier mention of winners and losers, we just mentioned tariffs now as well. US macro developments policy are, of course, hugely significant to the emerging markets complex. What's the outlook for EM fixed income in light of what we've discussed just now?
Sure, Max. When we think about the outlook for EM, some of the macro themes that we discussed are certainly going to play a pivotal role. First and foremost, the outlook for U.S. and by extension global growth is going to be of critical importance. A U.S. economy that's able to nail a soft landing should provide a constructive backdrop for emerging markets. And then similarly, monetary policy could also be a potential tailwind for EM as well. The Fed has finally embarked upon its rate cutting cycle, and that should give the green light for a broadening of the EM rate cutting cycle, which should at least provide a boost for EM local bonds. So what is something that could upset the apple cart for EM here? Well, we do think that the EM can encounter some headwinds in the lead up to the election, as elevated uncertainty may trigger an uptick in volatility. Post-election, of course, and we already talked about the impact of tariffs, but it's likely to weigh on EM economies that have a closer trade relationship with the U.S. in the event of a Trump victory. Just to contextualize this, if you look at 2016, for example, on a Trump victory, EM spreads moved meaningfully wider in the aftermath. In 2020, if you compare what happened there, you saw EM spreads move materially tighter on a Biden victory. So we do think that politics is going to play a critical role, at least in the near term, for EM. I would note, though, in 2020 when spreads, in 2016 when spreads did widen out post a Trump victory here, that was a dip that was meant to be bought. And you saw spreads start to come in the medium term. So I think from a short-term perspective, politics are going to play a critical role. But we do think that there's going to be some opportunities as volatility ticks higher, depending on the outcome here.
Thanks, Anthony. So really momentous weeks for that EM apple cart you discuss just now. Well, Sonia, we've covered a lot of ground in this brief call. Now, what are the key takeaways for investors? And is there anything you'd like to add before we approach wrapping up?
Thanks, Max. And as you say, I think we've covered a vast range of topics, of course, very much focusing on the US election, but clearly the US election will have huge implications for the rest of the world. And I would like to go back to where I started, which is, I believe, very important for investors. Has the narrative changed? Are we seeing the data actually supporting a move away from this idea that we're in for a soft landing and that inflation will move back to target and hence we will have supportive monetary policy? Because that, at the end of the day, is what really matters to market pricing. And you've heard various points around valuation levels. And it's the combination of those two that investors need to take note of, because we might see a very asymmetric risk-return profile should the narrative change. And the election, of course, and this, I hope, has been very clear in the discussion today, the election can matter within that narrative because of the fiscal situation, tariffs. We heard a lot of arguments how this can influence the medium to longer term trajectory of US growth and inflation, and of course, likewise in Europe and around the world. And it's in that context that investors need to be very clear on where the risks and opportunities are, because, of course, spreads have been mentioned a couple of times. It might well be that we can see scenarios where, of course, spreads will widen. And we should mention equities at this point, because it's very clear that equity valuations would be equally vulnerable to any significant shift in that narrative. And With that in mind, we have been seeing that it's been central bank policy in the near term that has been the key driver of market activity, but we should not lose sight that the big goalposts that have been shifting can, of course, shift further. And it's very, very important to position accordingly if volatility were to pick up. Diversification and understanding the very specific implications of the big political themes are well reflected and well understood in order to avoid any major negative surprises going forward. So with that in mind, I hope this was a very useful call. I know we've covered a lot of ground, but of course, a lot of this is covered in our CIO Outlook that we have just published.
Yes, thank you, Sonia, for those comments. It's a great reminder for me to nudge all of our listeners to look on the Elgin blog or on our various websites to find that document, which includes coverage across a range of asset classes and capabilities. Finally, before we sign off, I would just like to ask you all what you've been watching, reading or listening to recently, as we do on all of these calls. I will get the ball rolling and say I've been reading The Secret Pilgrim by John le Carré. It's the last in his Smiley series about great powers and espionage in a time of great geopolitical change, and it still feels very relevant today. Anthony, what have you been consuming?
Sure. In terms of what I've been reading, I'm currently working my way through the book, The Mindful Athlete. I'm a huge basketball fan, and the author, George Mumford, he used to work with Phil Jackson's Bulls and Lakers teams, basically guiding them on the art of meditation. I do think that the messaging there transcends sports. I think that investors can certainly learn to block out all the noise and try to get in their zone. I think that's conducive to producing optimal performance. So you see the parallel between sports and investing there as well. So that's the book that I'm reading right now.
Thanks, Anthony. Sonia?
I have actually been reading a really interesting book called The Trading Game, A Confession. It's written by Gary Stevenson, and it's a review of his story in the city. He's been a very famous trader, actually, at Citibank. And it gives you some very interesting insights into the working of a trading desk in what I probably would describe the good old days. I'm pretty sure if you were to write this memoir again, it would look a bit different. But it's actually fascinating, and it's an easy read as well.
Thanks, Sonia. Jason Becker.
Well, over the last 2 weeks, the honest answer has been a lot of NFL football. but I did recently finish reading Matthew Syed's Black Box Thinking. The book explores embracing failure and learning from mistakes as the key to achieving success. The author looks at it through the lens of various industries, with airlines being one of the key ones, hence the title of the book. But I think it's extremely applicable to investing as well.
Okay, so we've got a good mix here of kind of sports and investing content. Jason Shoup, over to you.
I'll keep mine short. I just started a book called The Missing Billionaires, which was an economist, favorite or list at the end of last year. I'm hoping that I can finish it before they come up with a new one for this year, a new list of books to read. And it's about, essentially investment sizing and why we don't have a lot more very wealthy people who've managed to hold on to their fortunes, right, and grow them.
Sounds fascinating. We've got a great list of activity for our listeners going forward. That's a great point on which to end this call as well. Thank you, Sonia, the two Jasons, and Anthony for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. You can find our latest updates on our social media channels, on the Elgin blog, and of course here on Elgin Talks. The next edition of this podcast will be in November, when Sonia and Jason Shoup will be joined by Tim Drayson to digest the US election results.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of Legal & General Investment Management Limited, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for information purposes only, and we are not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general economic, market or political issues and/or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not an offer or recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against Legal & General in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this document contains third-party information, the accuracy and completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person resident in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulation. Copyright 2024. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. In Hong Kong, this material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on X, formerly known as Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.